Welcome to Iteration, a podcast about programming, development, and design through the lens of amazing books, chapter by chapter. My name is John, and joining me, as always, is JP. Hey, JP.
How's it going? Happy belated Thanksgiving.
Yeah, happy belated Thanksgiving. Yeah, it's going really well. I worked this weekend, but it was super productive. Really good weekend, really good day today. I was up in Santa Barbara all day, which was kind of cool, working out of a co-working space up there.
Oh, nice.
But yeah, it's been a good day. Just kind of got back in and excited to jump into this chapter this week for sure. What about you? What's been going on for you?
Totally. Yeah, I just had basically a four-day vacation. I mean, so did basically everybody who's in the working world and not freelancing potentially. It's interesting. Like, I haven't touched our code base in 4 days, and I feel so refreshed. Like, I'm ready to jump right back into it. But at the same time, it's like, oh man, I haven't seen this code in 4 days. It's like, what is this? It's like foreign to me almost. Obviously not. That's funny. Exaggerating, but it sure feels like that.
Did you really take the long holiday weekend to really step away from code, or were you kind of in things all weekend?
No, I said I stepped away from work.
Oh, okay.
I'm messing with this website called hackingwithswift.com, which is probably going to be my pick actually, but it's basically like a ton of Swift and iOS tutorials. It's really cool. So it was cool to like shift away from the work I've been doing and like sort of solve different problems with a different programming language. That's always fun.
Totally. That's awesome. It was like the best few work days. I took Thanksgiving off and it was a really great day with family, but like Friday, Saturday, Sunday, I didn't hear from basically any contractors, didn't hear from any clients. And I was able to like really do some deep coding again. I feel so many of my days are so distracted by clients and contractors, it's tough to really focus. So like some of my coworkers and stuff. And so it was really good to like do some deep good work and some refactors that needed to be done. And I got a lot done. And like to this morning, Monday morning, I started inbox zero for the first time in like forever. Whoa. So it just felt really good to jump into this week really good. And I didn't work too much on the weekends. I worked like 6-7 hour days and made sure to get some bike rides and had some fun this weekend too. So it was good stuff.
Yeah. I'm trying to get back into like a routine of like exercising, being healthy, stepping away from the computer, stepping away from work. It's like you have to, you're going to drive yourself crazy if you don't.
Yeah. For me, jogging and bike riding really, really keep me sane. And it's so useful to unplug and get away and exert some energy out there. It makes a big difference. For coming back to work, it makes a huge difference for me. Cool. So I'm excited to get into this chapter. So we are on chapter 4 of Practical Object Oriented Design in Ruby by Sandy Metz. And this chapter is called Creating Flexible Interfaces. I feel like every chapter name is kind of the same words, just different. Just synonyms rearranged again.
Kind of.
But essentially this chapter Sandy says this chapter is all about methods within a class and how and what they expose to others and defining the interface of class. So that's a lot of wonky bullshit. So she starts the chapter out with this metaphor of a kitchen and a restaurant. And so she's like, look, a kitchen and a restaurant has all these messy implementation details. You know, when you go into a restaurant and you order a bowl of spaghetti, they go in the back, they have to prep the noodles, they have to boil the tomatoes, they have to cut the onions, and there's all these people involved and nuance. And if it's Gordon Ramsay's kitchen, they're cursing and these things throwing around. That's right. It's raw. It's fucking raw. But there's all this stuff going on in the kitchen that you don't see as the end client. There's an interface to the restaurant kitchen, and the interface is the menu. And so it's that simple as someone coming into the restaurant to order a bowl of spaghetti, and that's what you get. You get a completed bowl of spaghetti out of that kitchen window, and it comes up through the interface, if you will, of your server. And I love this analogy. I think it's really apt, and it describes it really well. This idea that your model, the other models shouldn't know too much about them. They should only know what they're looking for. And this is overall this concept we're going to be diving into with some code examples and specific domain examples. But for me, this defined that idea of how a model should behave within the context of other models so eloquently. And to me, I'm just like, okay, cool. I'll never forget this idea that my model is a kitchen and the interface is the menu. And I loved that way she opened up the chapter.
Yeah, totally. It's like if I order a hamburger, I don't care how you make it. I just expect that what comes back is a hamburger or a pizza or a bowl of spaghetti. I'm not like sending instructions to the kitchen saying, hey, after 2 minutes, I want you to flip the patty and then make sure that it's this temperature. I just like expect that it's going to come back as I asked for. And that's like what this is all about.
Mm-hmm.
It's cool because this chapter talks about like public versus private interfaces. But as a result of that, like, we sort of dive into the topics of like what should be a public method and what should be a private method. And I remember very early on in my programming career, I was like, what the heck's the difference between like a public and a private method? And like, why do I need to have private methods? Because like, essentially, they're just methods within this class. But it wasn't until like reading this book that I truly understand like, oh, okay, this should be a private method because I can abstract some of these implementation details. And I only need to call this method within this class. Like, other classes shouldn't be able to call this method. Therefore, it should be private.
Yeah, let's just jump right into this idea of public versus private methods. So, you know, in a way, we can use this metaphor of the kitchen, but it falls down pretty quick. We need to start talking about code examples. But so we're talking about specifically in Ruby, there's keywords of public versus private. And there's another keyword that's protected, I think, that I've never really used or seen, but it was in this chapter as well. And yeah, I am totally with you that I didn't have a great understanding of public versus private methods before reading this chapter and understanding those implementations. Because the only real place that I use that I write private methods is really within controllers, within Rails. And my understanding is like, oh, this is something that's kind of protected. It's a different class of methods, which is all kind of true. But I'm really underselling it by not really using them in models. And I've seen a lot of like framework code and a lot of different models using the private keywords within models, but I don't think I've actually written a model with the private keyword in it. I just write methods within the model and call it a day when I have enough methods. And I like this intentionality around the idea of public versus private. But the idea behind these keywords in Ruby, the way that I understand them, is that it makes it so that you can't call that method from any other place but within that own model. So let's say we have a user model and there's a private method that's send password reset, which is probably a bad method name, but let's just go with that for a second. The idea is that you can't call user.sendPasswordReset anywhere but from the user object itself, an instantiation of the user object. So it has to call it on self. So there's a lot of benefits from this. And I really like Sandy's argument of like, it's not necessarily like a security idea because it's not 100% secure. There's ways to get around these private versus public methods. It's really just to enforce a best practice of what is should be accessible to itself, almost like tools or resources for the model versus what other models should be calling from it. So if we kind of like play off this idea of a restaurant as a kitchen, it's like grill a burger could be a private method for the kitchen, the idea of grilling a burger. But me as a customer or even the server, the wait staff, they shouldn't know the method of grill a burger. They don't care. They shouldn't be calling that grill a burger. And I'm just like thinking about code bases and how many times that I'm calling methods from objects that they shouldn't be calling. And really this idea of separating that, whether or not you're using the keywords, but I think it's good to start using them. I think I'm going to. But whether or not you use the keywords to think about messages and who's calling them and why, and should they really be calling that kind of a method?
Yeah, I actually really, really enjoy this kitchen metaphor. I think like it like actually kind of holds up in the context of talking about public and private interfaces, right? Because like, let's say we have a burger class and we have a like perform method. And this perform method could be like the algorithm for making a burger. It's like take out bread, take out patty, flip patty, yeah. Right? Grill burger, whatever, right?
But
like,
I'm with you.
But these like implementation details, you shouldn't be able to call these methods within perform on the instance of a burger, right? So like as a customer, I shouldn't be able to like do like a burger instance burger dot flip, right? Because that's the job of like the chef, like the internals. So like that would be a private method. All I can do is call like burger dot perform, or in that case burger dot cook or grill or whatever it is. So that's really cool. I have a bunch of bullet point notes that I have as like a copy and paste alert that I think are probably worth discussing, right?
So there's, yeah, let's like talk through them.
There's like a compare and contrast of like what describes a public interface and what describes a private interface.
Yeah, this section was really good. I have those same notes, like way too many notes on my screen here as well.
Cool. Yeah. So like a public interface reveals the primary responsibility expected to be invoked by others, will not change on a whim, safe for others to depend on, thoroughly documented in tests, right? So if we have a perform method on burger, or for all intents and purposes, we'll call it a dot cook, right? Burger dot cook.
Sure.
You should be able to call that from, or maybe it's like burger.deliver to customer, right? Because like I shouldn't be able to tell them when to cook, right? So it's like burger.deliver. That is like what I can depend on from like from external classes should be able to depend on that. And whatever the implementation details, you know, doesn't really matter. On the other hand, in contrast, private interfaces handle the implementation details, not expected to be sent by other objects. They can change for whatever reason. And I mean, that goes hand in hand with the whole like implementation details, right? Because that's where like all the nitty gritty stuff is. And it's not safe for others to depend on because they can change. And as like a personal thing, like I tend to not test my private methods. I test my public methods and expect them to spit out something. And it just happens to be like the private methods that are doing all of those calculations. So it's kind of cool that like it like cleans up the methods that you test because your private methods are just like a black box that does something.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really good takeaway too, because it lets you focus your tests. And again, lets you think about this, like what is the important ones that need to be stable versus what's the supporting code? Because I feel like at times I'll write unit tests against things that it's like, it feels odd to write it against it because like it can, the implementation of this unit test could particularly change. Mm-hmm. Like, and I can't give an exact example of what that looks like, but because that method supports other methods, like it's okay if the specific implementation of that method changes. I mean, to use the kitchen metaphor, it's like, I don't care what brand of spatula you use to flip the burger. Like, mm-hmm. I don't need to unit test the spatula. Mm-hmm. As long as I know that the flip method works, which is, you know, let's say a method there, then I don't care. Or if the cook method is working, then I don't care what brand of spatula you're using. And this is kind of the getting weird, and we're really stretching this metaphor, and I think we'll continue to do so. But it's that idea of like what's important and how to request it. Stepping back for a little bit of a second in the chapter, before jumping into this idea of public and private methods, Sandy talked about the way messages pass between an application and a well-designed application and a poorly designed application, and really prioritizing the way we think about messages and how they pass. And there's two graphics, and it's a cluster of nodes, if you will, and each node kind of represents a different model or concept in the domain. And then there was lines between them that represent all the different messages being passed. And a well-designed application has like strategic and well-placed lines that make sense for these lines of communications to talk to each other. And the other application just has this total mishmash of lines. Every single node is connected to every other node. And I really like this illustration because if you think about in context with private versus public methods, bringing it back to this, it's really about having less points of contact between your models, really only having each one know just enough about the others to do the job that it needs to do. And really going back to that kitchen idea, like in the model of this restaurant kitchen, I'm going to request a burger and I'm going to get a burger back. I'm not going to be like, okay, get the bread, do these, all these different things. And I just like, I'm feeling all the times I've experienced so much pain in refactors and test coverages, realizing that I have models talking to way too many other methods and way too exposed and intertwined to each other. Mm-hmm. So Sandy really describes all this and tries to walk through all this through this kind of this domain design that she suggests, which is kind of the startup of this bicycle touring service. Do we want to talk through the example?
Yeah. So it's cool because we step away from like code. And so this chapter is really just high level, making you think as a reader, like, how can I ask for what instead of giving imperative directions on like, this is how you should be doing these things. So instead of talking about a specific gear and bicycle class that we've been previously discussing in the first three chapters, we're going through like a theoretical like system design of a startup called, it's like a bicycle touring company. And so there's a couple of specs. I tried to pare it down so that there's not too many, so that like we can just give the listeners just enough to know the context behind it. So here's the bullet points. We're creating a startup for a bicycle touring company. It's called Fast Feet Inc. It's a company that offers road and mountain bike trips. So each trip has limitations on the number of customers who may go and requires a specific number of guides who double as mechanics. So each route is rated according to difficulty, and you can rent bikes or you can bring your own. Rental bikes come in various sizes and are suitable for either road trips or mountain bike trips. So that's like sort of the generic idea behind it. Now there's a lot of other details that I chose to forego, but I think that's enough to get
that's like, a good overview,
good context, right? So here's the use case. You have a customer, in order to choose a trip, would like to see a list of the available trips and their level of difficulty on a specific date, and also where rental bikes are available. So like already there's a lot of different questions that need to be answered in different objects. So like if you're already thinking of the different objects in your head, like, oh, you know, there might be like a routes object where there's like the different trips, or like, sorry, a trips object, or like a mechanics object and a bike rental object, right? And so like in this use case, I already want to see the list of trips, and I want to see the level of difficulty. I need to know what dates they're available, and I need to know what rental bikes are available. So like inherently, this is like an application that has a lot going on, where objects do need to talk to each other. And it's just a matter of like, how do we, she poses this question of like, how do we construct this app, and how can we design it so that it's not the image where it's like a bunch of intertwined mumbo jumbo. It really should just be like a bowl of spaghetti, right? Because of like, it's literally spaghetti
classic,
code.
Yeah.
How can we avoid spaghetti code and have something that is like very, where you can actually trace the messages from where they're being passed, and so it's not like a tangled up mess.
And so she walks through all these and gives a lot of really awesome examples. Really encourage you to read the book, but we'll try to give you the best tidbits from it. She breaks all this down in this UML diagrams called sequence diagrams, and it's a technical way to describe the way messages are being passed to different things. We're not going to try to explain what's in these different diagrams, but I do want to walk through one example. And there's this idea that you have a trip, and you have bicycles needed for a trip, and you have mechanics that do the work on bicycles. So if you think about it, I want to go on a bike tour, I need a bicycle, but then that bicycle needs to be cleaned, it has to have the tires pumped up, the chain lube, the brakes checked, just to make sure I'm all safe to prepare the bicycle for a trip. So in the initial example, in the code example, she walks through a trip knowing about the bicycle, and then a trip model requesting to clean a bicycle, pump the tires, lube the chain, check the brakes, and then it's ready for that trip. And I've made this mistake 1,000 times, like having one model make a ton of different requests, basically calling methods from another model. I've done this time and time again. And a better way to approach this, which is a really great strong recommendation, is within your trip model, simply have a single method called prepare bicycle. And that's calling a mechanic method of prepare bicycle. And then the mechanic knows everything that needs to do to prepare a bicycle. So really going back to the kitchen metaphor, really instead of the person ordering the food saying, okay, here's what I want you to do. I want you to get beef. I want you to grind it up. I want you to take some bread. And then I want you to put together, like, no, they're just going to ask for a completed burger. The request is a bicycle. And then the mechanic object knows all those implementation details. So all I'm calling on behalf of the mechanic is prepare my bicycle. And then the mechanic is handling those implementation details. It's really not a matter of more or less code. It's technically a little bit less code. It's drier, but it's really a matter of who is responsible for this object or message and how am I asking for it? So instead of giving the mechanic object the implementation details of I want you to lube it, I want you to pump up the tires, I want you to check the brakes, I'm just telling the mechanic that I want a bicycle prepared. And I hope that I didn't butcher that whole metaphor that she set up for us.
No, that was perfect. Yeah. So just to reiterate, the problem with this is that inside of the trip, we have a method that calls all these different things against the mechanic. We're asking inside of the trip class, we're saying clean bicycle, pump tires, lube chain, check brakes. And that already should be like a red flag to you, because it seems like, okay, we're doing all of these things that the trip doesn't really need to know about. In fact, none of this has anything to do with the trip. All the trip wants is a bicycle that's ready to be taken on. It doesn't need to have any logic that has anything to do with cleaning it, pumping the tires, like the implementation of actually getting it ready. And so, yeah, so you're exactly right. So like you have to ask yourself, like, where does the responsibility lie? Is it the mechanic's responsibility to take care of this, or is this the trip's responsibility? And even when, you know, even just talking about this out loud, it just seems so obvious. Like, of course it's the mechanic's responsibility. Even like the personification of this code makes so much more sense that the mechanic knows about it, not the trip.
There was a really good quote from Sandy on this subject, which was, quote, if you fixate on domain objects, you'll tend to coerce behavior into them. Design experts notice domain objects without concentrating on them. They focus not on these objects, but on the messages that pass between them, unquote. And the idea here is, and this is totally where I tend to go, is I really focus on all of the nouns of my application, and I sometimes forget about all the different messages they're passing. And it really reminds me a lot of WizTutor, which is an application we talk about a lot, which is, you know, you can find and book tutors in person. And so we have this object of a tutoring session. But honestly, the entire application lives in these two objects, pretty much, a user and a tutoring session. So like, as a user, I request a tutoring session. And then, but see, the whole idea is that I was so fixated on finding these objects. It's a good example of a code base because there's so many mistakes because I wrote it like 3.5 years ago now, and it hasn't been refactored still in a lot of painful ways. But it's a lot of good examples of what not to do in some ways. And one of the main ones, the mistakes that I made, is the tutoring session object gets continuously passed around and permutated in state. Like, it's initially in this state of requested, and then it's in this new state of confirmed. When in reality, if I would have paid attention to the messages being passed, I would have realized that there's new objects waiting to get out. Like maybe a tutoring session request object, a confirmation object, like all these objects that are so waiting to be there, a cancellation object. Instead, every single time we're just patching the tutoring session with now, oh, it has a canceled time. It's like, this makes no sense when you start to look at all the different messages it's handling. The messages themselves are objects waiting to be defined. And that's really one of the takeaways from this, is like, if you think about the messages and not just the objects, you'll find a lot of other objects waiting to be discovered that can be then passed as things unto themselves.
Yeah, totally. I bet if we were to draw like one of those diagrams of like messages being sent back and forth between like a user and a tutoring session, it would just be like a hot potato of back and forth between the user and the tutoring session. And in fact, that might be what we were talking about in the last episode of like dependency direction. I feel like the dependency direction of the user object and the tutoring session object like alternates between the two. And so like it goes this direction and then it goes back in the other direction multiple times.
Yeah.
And ultimately, that just like makes it that much harder to like extend and follow the like bug traces, stack traces.
So there's another quote that I really liked about asking versus telling. So here it's, quote, when messages are trusting and ask for what the sender wants instead of telling the receiver how to behave, objects naturally evolve public interfaces that are flexible and reusable in novel and unexpected ways. Unquote. So the idea is that, again, like instead of telling how to make a burger or telling how to prepare a bike, loop the chain, I'm just asking for, hey, I need this bike prepared and that mechanic object can handle the implementation. Or, hey, I need this burger cooked and the kitchen object can handle the specific nuances of implementation between it. I feel like some of these are really a little bit contrived. Like we used WizTutor as a little bit of an example, but I struggle a little bit on some of these implementations, especially when talking about a refactor, because it's hard to know in a refactor, when looking at existing objects that are so intertwined like this, where to start and like what can be made private versus public. Like if I was to start implementing this in my code base tomorrow, I think starting from scratch, it makes a lot of sense to me. Like, okay, here's my main public methods that I want to be using, but it's difficult for me to know like, okay, right now, what should be private versus public? But I guess that's where test coverage comes in, and I could just write private somewhere and see what fails and see what I'm calling from other places.
Yeah, I think one good indication, now obviously this is like easier to talk about because it's theory, but like I feel like one indication that you might need to extract something out into a private method is that, you know, one, the method's too big and you're just like, how am I supposed to do like all these things are going on in this method? How am I supposed to test that it's happening? And so like, if you find yourself trying to test an implementation detail that is likely to change, I think that is like a good indication of, oh, hey, maybe this should be a private method and I don't even need to test it. In fact, I can just rely that X spits out Y and then that this method does this given these inputs. So that might be like a place to start.
And that kind of goes back to like the self-documenting smaller methods. Like if you've got a method that's really big, start to break it out into these smaller methods. And some of those smaller methods should probably be down below the private label. And then what's really interesting about that too is it encourages reuse so much more dramatically between your model. Because in a lot of ways, like these small methods that a model might need will often need them for more than one method. And so it enables your code to be really dry and thinking strategically about like, oh yeah, this one phone number formatting method, I'm actually formatting this phone number in four times within my user model or whatever that specific implementation looks like. It's like, okay, this is one small private method that just does this for all users and does that in a way that makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, might be a little unrelated, but a place that I tend to reach for private methods in like a test suite is, let's say I'm writing a capybara test and I want to encapsulate like five different lines of capybara like DSL code because it's doing the exact same things and I need to reuse that in, I don't know, three tests. So I might extract that into like an like assert page, assert button clicked and focused or something like that. So that could be like a private method. And I only want this method within this capybara test. And so I can like trust that like I'm never going to use that specific logic anywhere else. And it's like nicely encapsulated in its own method in the capybara test file. So that's like an example of like, oh, I should definitely use a private method there, but kind of unrelated to the idea of objects talking to each other and passing messages back. But I feel like the same principles can almost be applied of like, oh, I should probably reach for a private method.
No, I think it makes a ton of sense. So the next thing that Sandy really went into, which I thought was a little bit of a divergence from what she was talking about, was the idea of objects and contexts. So she talked about the idea that a specific object can have different contexts that makes its reuse really difficult. And this really goes back to WizTutor and this idea of this tutoring session has all these different contexts or states that it's in. So tutoring session is like in a requested state, in a confirmed state, like, you know, a requested session can't be started. Like there's all these weird states that it ends up in. And so you have to test it in all these different ways. And it makes it really, really difficult to reuse that object or any methods within it. And so if we had something more like a request object and a confirmation object, you could use the request for other types of things. You could use confirmations for other types of things or cancellations where everything is wrapped in this one object that has all these different contexts or states. It was a little bit of a tangent, but I think it was a good tangent to talk about for a second of the idea about managing context and thinking about objects that have a lot of different contexts against them. And it's probably other objects trying to get out.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I have like one bullet point takeaway from this and that it's like you can use dependency injection to solve this. So I think like my takeaway is like be cognizant of the data that you're mutating and if possible, don't mutate your data so you're not managing like a crazy, crazy big state machine when possible. I don't know. It feels like a very like ideal world kind of scenario. But yeah, it was a very interesting thing, like thinking about like the different contexts that an object can live in.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the last really good kind of section that she walked through was this idea of this trip finder object. So let's go back to the idea of this bicycle touring company. And, you know, the specific user is looking for a trip that matches a lot of requirements. So is there bikes available? Is there guides available? Is those dates available? And so the user object is querying all these different objects, probably four or five different objects, to find out if they're in a state that matches the state that they need to make that trip as an available trip and then returning that array of trips. And so if you realize really quickly, we have all these messages that belong to bicycles, messages that belong to mechanics, messages that belong to all these different objects, all being called by our user object. Its user is finding available trips.
Totally.
And automatically, we've learned from our kitchen metaphor and other metaphors that this is a really bad approach. And so Sandy, to clean all this up, recommends encapsulating a lot of that logic into its own object. So she introduces this trip finder object. So you can do trip finder.new, pass in the user, pass in the dates you're looking, and that trip finder can handle a lot of that implementation nitty gritty detail. I really love this idea. It's one that I was introduced to a while ago regarding search objects, because the way I would used to solve search in a lot of my code bases is to put like a custom controller method of an action of search and then put all my search logic into my user's controller, whatever controller I'm trying to search. And then it just made code reuse hard. I'm putting other named, you know, types of methods within my searches. It's so not the way to go. I've you know, the idea of the service object that can encapsulate a search query or query object that we've talked about in kind of other podcasts and things is a really good approach to try to make a single object with a single responsibility. Yet in this case, it is talking to other objects, but it's encapsulated all in one place in a way that knows less about other things. And so it's this kind of this bridge object that ties together your different objects. And it's very related to, it is a service object in a way, but it's a little bit different because it's mainly talking to your own code base. And in a way, it's more like a query object, but it's a service object. That's
I love that term you just coined, a bridge object. Because
yeah, bridge object.
We should make that, that should be a thing. And because that's like totally what it is, right? Like you don't want to muddy up your user. You don't want to muddy up your trip. You don't want to muddy up your bicycle. And it's like, do I just have to call like trip.new and then call like get trip ready on both the trip and the bicycle? Like it becomes like this weird thing. So instead of doing that, you can have like a trip finder class. I love that because it sort of delegates all of that responsibility and you don't have to worry about like having stray queries everywhere. If we're talking about like a Rails app or something.
For sure. I think that a really good go-to is for search, for sure. Something like a trip finder or search object. The other one that I was implementing in a production code base the other day is a comparison object. So it was literally comparison.new for comparison shopping. So this product has the ability to compare several different things. And so you can pass in two objects and it gives you a comparison view and controller. And so none of this comparison logic is living on the products or on the user. It's actually encapsulated into this search object that's this comparison object. But there's a lot of different implementations, and that's a really good resource. If you feel like you're calling too many different methods and too many different things, there's probably an object waiting to get out that can kind of encapsulate that.
Yeah, super interesting. And I love this chapter in general, because even though we're talking about Rails apps, like this is just good object-oriented design in general. Like this could just be like a command line app. It doesn't have to be a web application. This is just like practical object-oriented programming.
Oh, wait. Yeah, I think that's the whole point.
Practical object-oriented programming poop.
Nice. Super excited for next week. We're going to be jumping into duck typing, which I'm super excited about. I'm just starting to learn about it. Just started the chapter today, and I'm excited for next week. So do you have any picks for us this week?
Yes, it's what I mentioned earlier, hackingwithswift.com. It's like a super good resource for people who want to learn Swift. My biggest gripes with other resources I've had in the past is like the resources sort of assume that you have like no programming knowledge. And this one kind of does too, because there's like an intro to like the programming language, but it doesn't go through the concept of like what an array is and like iterating through an array. And don't forget that arrays are a zero index. So you have to, it's like, okay, I know all that stuff. Just teach me about the language and teach me about iOS. And that's exactly what this resource is giving me. And there's like so much in the Apple or in like the iOS APIs that like making a native iOS app is like crazy different than like importing some components from React Native. I was actually talking to Dale about this earlier because we're trying to interview at Open Listings
for
mobile
Dale.
Developers. Yeah, Dale, what's up? He's probably like one of our five listeners. No, I'm kidding. But I hit him up to ask him for help potentially like constructing like how I would interview someone for iOS because we're looking for mobile developers at Open Listings. That's my little plug. And yeah, so I like asked him for help because like the APIs are just so complex. And he was like talking about how it would probably be pretty cool for us to talk about like what the differences are between iOS and React Native at some point.
Oh, that would be interesting to jump into a little bit.
Yeah, totally. But this, anyways, back to this resource. It's really good. And it like goes through like creating 40 different apps with Swift. And each tutorial dives a little bit deeper into a specific Apple API. Because there's just so many different things. Like the difference between rendering a scrolled like list view type thing in React Native versus doing it in Swift is like, it's kind of like breaking my brain a little bit. I think it's just a little bit of me being unfamiliar with it, but it just seems like very complex. And I totally get why you have to use Xcode, is because like the function signatures are absolutely fucking bonkers. Like, I don't know. There's like no way you'd be able to like remember all of these different, like the different things you have to pass in, the different, like the long variable names. There's like so many different things you have to pass into a function to make it work. It's just like, you just have to use Xcode. There's no way you're not using Xcode.
For sure.
But
And what was the website again? Hack with Swift. Is that it?
Hackingwithswift.com.
Hacking with Swift. Okay, cool. We'll make sure to put that in the show notes. Super cool. Thanks for sharing. My pick is a weird one. So I've been doing a lot of React Native development, and we're having a lot of trouble like doing the final builds to deploy to the app stores between different developers' machines, just because when you get all of the different CocoaPods and different Xcode versions, there's a lot of nuance with compiling to React Native that makes it really potentially painful. Where like running it on simulators or even on device is pretty consistent across different platforms, but actually doing the final build compile, I feel like the Xcode is super fragile when it comes to some of those dependencies. Like I remember two of our versions of Xcode were a single point off and it wouldn't build on another one of our machines. And like getting those old versions of Xcode up and running, and it's a total nightmare. But like the general day-to-day development isn't too painful for those, you know, different dependencies. So I was looking for a lot of different solutions for this. And just the first solution we started with led me to this product, this website called Mac Stadium. It's this place in Las Vegas that's some warehouse somewhere that's just full of Macs. And you can rent a dedicated Mac for $60 a month. They even have cheaper plans, but like for a decent hardware, for like a Mac Mini that's like 256 gigs of hard drive and stuff, they rent you a Mac Mini for $60 a month. And so until we can deploy something that, like a more automated build tool, which I'm hoping to get toward in the future, we actually have this like perfectly hermetically sealed Mac that just sits on a server that we know that we can consistently build to. And it's been so cool. And I have two of these remote Macs, and it's like very satisfying. And I didn't really understand how well supported that virtual machine sharing is on OS X. Like there's built-in screen sharing tools into the OS, and it like feels like you're sitting at that Mac. And there's something that's really fucking cool about like clicking a button on a website. 5 minutes later, they put whatever version of OS X you want on it. They email you a link, you click the link, and you're like using a fresh machine. And it's like fully your machine. You can do whatever you want with it. Like you can set it up however you want. You can even like dual boot it. Like you can do whatever you want with that machine, and it's dedicated to you. And it's like been really cool to kind of learn this. And like I work with a couple of guys on the team who run Linux, and it's been really nice to just literally shoot them a link to a machine with the thing running on iOS that they need to check out. And they can like use it from their Linux machine, and it doesn't bog down their machine. I can even like do an iOS build on the remote machine just to not bog down my local machine. Like there's something that's like really cool about all these different use cases that I didn't realize how convenient they would be and how useful they would be. And like for only like, I think it's like between 40 and 80 bucks a month, like you can get all the way up to a Mac Pro that's like maxed out. And like, if you think about it, you could buy a Chromebook and rent 80 bucks a month and like you could do pro video editing. And like, there's also like other weird use cases. Like I've used it a couple times when I had a bad internet connection, and it has 100 megabit internet connection. Yeah. So even though I'm on a constrained connection, I can use the 100 megabit connection. Like it's weird that you get this portal to this like perfectly connected machine that's like fresh. It's just a really, anyway, I've been super impressed with the whole renting the machine. It's like all automated. It's super easy. It's totally affordable. And it's just this really interesting thing. And I'm like trying to come up with some other use cases for it, because it's like just this interesting idea of these remote Macs. So MacStadium.com, check it out. It's been really interesting. And I'm hoping to find some other good use cases for it. So that's my pick.
Sweet. That sounds really cool. Okay. Super excited about next chapter, duck typing, not to be confused with rubber ducking. But yeah, we will catch you guys next time.
Absolutely. Thanks for listening. For sure, just tell your friends about the podcast. We'd really appreciate it. iterationpodcast.com. You can find our Twitters, reach out to us, whatever, blah, blah, blah. Talk to you guys next week.
Peace.